it's become a bit of a cliche, I think, in these introductions to say that the person that who's speaking this evening needs no introduction, because most of you know him already. This week there's no cliche about it, it's just an absolutely dead set true. it's really nice to have Par Engstrom back with us. Obviously, Par is a long-standing member of OTJR. Par essentially invented the Working Paper series on our website that has become such a success over the last 18 months. Pa was our inaugural chief editor and is still on the editorial board, is very involved with OTJR, still also editing our current conference collection as well, that is taking very nice shape. But Pa, of course, has moved on to bigger and better things. You know, we'd like to think we had some sort of contribution to the stellar places that he has ended up. Of course, that's a complete lie, it's not his own steam, but Pa's now a lecturer in human rights at the Human Rights Consortium in London. Part of the School of Advanced Studies at the University of London, and it's a real pleasure, Parter, to have you back here and to speak to us this evening on the topic of transitional justice and the inter-American human rights system, a topic, of course, very close to Par's area of expertise. Thanks very much.
Okay, thanks, Phil. Thanks for coming. As I kind of pointed out before, we have some competition today, so I think it is a reflection of the strength of the seminar series more than any strength of what I'm going to say, the fact that you chose to come here instead of to Senator Day O'Connor, or for that matter, Professor Kaplan's peace building seminar series. Now, what I'm trying to do today, I guess, and I'm very grateful for kind of, you know, being pushed a bit, having signed up to give a presentation, to be pushed to think perhaps a bit more systematically about the American human rights system with regards to transitional justice trends or transitional justice issues across the region of Latin America. My own research up to date has predominantly focused on Argentina and to some extent comparatively with Chile and Brazil. So you're going to notice some of that in the type of illustrations and example I'm using today. But what I'm trying to do here is to think broadly about the development of the American human rights system with regards to transitional justice. And I should also say that this paper and, you know, these thoughts are supposed to be part of a broader project on post-transitional justice. That Kath Collins at Universidad Diego Portales in Santiago, Chile, is leading, looking into recent trends that in certain Latin American countries that have seen the overturning of amnesty provisions and amnesty laws, and the opening up of human rights trials up to 2 to 3 decades after the human rights violations have taken place. So what I'm trying to do here is to try to think about how the inter-American system and the type of norms, institutions that the system has developed over time has contributed to some extent to this these more recent trends. So I guess what I've divided my comments here in three parts. I'm going to talk, hopefully briefly, about general transitional justice trends in Latin America. And the reason for me doing that is two, I guess. One, that there's no one Latin American experience with transitional justice, but there's several ones, and they are often contrasting. And the reason for them being contrasted, I'll get to in a minute. But I think it's important to understand a bit how the development of transitional justice has taken place in various countries in order to locate the more recent the recent developments with regards to trials. And then in the second part, I will try to say something hopefully intelligible about regional norms within the inter-American system and how these norms have influenced domestic outcomes in various ways in certain countries. And basically, I think the key point I'm making here is that clearly there's a range of domestic factors that explain the development of towards social justice in Latin America over time, but I argue that the American system has become increasingly important in inserting itself into transnational justice debates in various ways, and we'll go into some detail in those various ways. And then, thirdly, I will try to put the question to myself and perhaps to you, if this matters at all. Okay, why does this matter? And I guess what I'm going to say there is that, yes, it matters at an individual level, okay? It does matter for individuals who are using the American system, quite clearly. But, and here I'm more tentative, it may have broader implications than that, and hopefully going to get to a point where I could make some linkages between the ways in which issues of the past, human rights abuse in the past, can have influence in the ways in which human rights are being promoted and respected in the present. But again, more tentative. So that's the agenda. Let's see if I achieve any of this. Now, firstly, unpacking a bit the transitional justice trends in Latin America. As I said, there's no one Latin American experience for transitional justice, but several and contrasting one. And they are contrasting in terms of, one, the human rights abuses that took place under different kinds of political regimes in Latin America. And they are different in terms of the approaches that were adopted with regard to transitional justice following the transition in key countries. Now, I suspect that not all of you are experts on Latin American politics, so I will briefly just go through some of this. Broadly speaking, you could say there are three categories wherein dirty wars occurred in Latin America, okay, and that some great differences within these cases. But you could say, one, there were the military governance and national security states which emerged in the southern cone countries of Argentina, Brazil, Chile, and Uruguay in the late 1960s and 70s. Then you have a second category of political regimes where abuses took place, and they were in Central America during the 1980s, where dirty war tactics were used by military or civil military counterinsurgency states. And then thirdly, you have a category of countries such as Peru, Colombia, Mexico, where dirty war tactics were used against insurgent movements or political opponents by states who had either maintained constitutional government, in the case of Colombia, had undergone some transition from military to civilian rule, in the case of Peru, and that had long-standing civilian but authoritarian regime, in the case of Mexico. Okay. Now, why these regimes emerged, of course, is a whole debate within comparative politics, but a range of key factors for explaining why they did and why they adopted the practice that they did. I'm not going to go into these, of course, but I think it's important to highlight what some of them are to understand a bit how these countries developed after the fall of these regimes. First, of course, we have to understand that when you talk about Latin American politics in this period, you cannot distinguish it, or you can't separate that from the context of the Cold War and the Cold War ideologies that very much influenced the type of repression that ensued. Then, of course, you have a set of long-run historical explanations that focus on the ways in which these societies develop from economic and social perspective. So in terms of very rapid mobilization of working class sectors of society, and how these elites put in place policies to suppress that mobilization, and then of course you have to look at the ways in which the military forces themselves, the armed forces, develop their role in society. And so on and so forth. Okay. Now, so the political context, the point I was making before, the political context was in which these abuses took place vary substantially. Okay, but the dirty war label has become generic, and in many ways, what brings these cases together is the similarities in the mechanisms that the states employed that led to human rights violations. Many of these mechanisms, of course, are familiar to us all. Disappearances, forced disappearances, of course. Here, it's important to make the point that the practice of forced disappearance varied substantially from one country to another. So we had approximately 3,000 disappeared in Chile, low hundreds in Brazil, Uruguay, Honduras, up to 30,000 in Argentina, and very contested numbers here. El Salvador between 25 to 30,000 and approximately 50,000 in Guatemala. And now recently it has been established that it was around 70,000 in Peru. And of course, this the practice of forced disappearance was used in order to atomize and rule societies through fear. Of course, torture was also widely used, both among those who were formally arrested, but also those who had disappeared. Again, the use of torture varies. Okay, in these countries, for example. In the case of Uruguay, there was a very low number of forced disappeared, but there was extensive use of torture, okay, amongst employed by the, or used by the military regimes. Now, also in terms of legal mechanisms that were developed, military courts were significantly expanded in terms of their jurisdiction, and they were given powers to try civilians accused of crimes against states. Very expansive use of degree of emergency, decrees of emergencies, and also statutes that suspended constitutional protections. And of course, impunity widely used, partly as a reflection of the weakness of the judicial system to put up any challenge to the ways in which the political rulers and military rulers used. How their policies led to human rights violations. Now, the reason why I'm going through this is in part to understand a bit the context that that preceded the transitional justice policies that adopted, because for these societies, these differences are important in explaining and understanding what came after. Now, so given these differences, the efforts that followed differed as well. So there were different institutional mechanisms and policies adopted with regards to establishing truth and justice in the countries involved. There was different balance between the political forces in the country and social force, but particularly with regards to the relationship between the military and the civilian regimes that came into power. And also, quite importantly, in how the legacy of the military was perceived. Again, to this day, Chile, the military has considerable support for what it did during the military regime, whilst in Argentina it's broadly discredited for its role. And also, there were key tensions between the expectations on the part of civil society actors and the political constraints on the part of political elites. Of course, this is very much reflected in the kind of key debate between Carlos Nino, Argentine political and constitutional lawyer, and Diane Oren Lischer in the 90s regarding the duty to prosecute. Of course, on one hand, Nino emphasized the very real political constraints that Argentine democratic regime faced, whilst Oren Lischer very much put forward a very strong argument for there being a duty to prosecute, no matter what the political realities and constraints are. Now, just to kind of situate some of these issues here. Now, again, in Argentina, what you had was a transition by military collapse. The Alfonsín government initially tried some of the military junta, but this was overturned following military unrest. In Chile, the transition was more gradual. It was a pacted transition and focusing more on acknowledgement of what happened in the past than focusing on punishment. In Uruguay, you had an amnesty law that was passed by the civilian government, not by the military. And this amnesty was supported by in a referendum in 89. Sorry. In Brazil, what you had was a very protracted period of democratization, and which was controlled by the military. The military passed an amnesty law, granting pardons to both sides, so to speak, of the conflict. In Peru, the Fujimori in 95, he passed an amnesty law that covered all the human rights abuses that took place between 1980 and the time of the amnesty law was passed. In Central America, you had a context in which transitional justice was discussed as part and a consequence of peace processes, where the UN played a very important part in truth and reconciliation processes. Now, again, the key point that I want to make here is to try to understand some, kind of acknowledge some of the differences as well as the similarities in the initial transitional justice policies that were adopted. Okay, so this is just some historical context here. Now, what has happened since then? What are the recent trends of post-transitional justice? And here we're talking about between 20 and 30 years after the initial transitional justice policies were adopted. In Argentina, you have very extensive prosecutions of military and police officers. The most up-to-date figures I have is that you have 1,400 individuals are being processed through the Argentine judicial system. So, and this followed, of course, the overturning of the laws that prevented prosecution. I will get into that in a few moments or so. In Chile, you have, surprising perhaps, but what seemed to be promising, that by the end of last year, the most up-to-date figures I have is that you have 700 former regime agents, both police and military, being charged or processed. There are 340 legal investigations and so on and so forth. Okay. In Peru, what we have following the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, some initial attempts to prosecute military officers through the courts. You have, of course, Fujimori's recent conviction before Peruvian courts. Okay, in Mexico and Brazil, that had long-standing traditions of impunity. There are even efforts to revisit the past. I will come to Mexico in a few moments, but in the case of Brazil, recently the Lula government has come out in support of a truth commission, and he's expected to announce his decision in a few days. People involved in this process, they claim that the Inter-American system has influenced this decision, given a recent case that has ended up before the Inter-American court that challenges the amnesty law that was passed by the military regime. However, the Brazilian government is very much divided on this issue. We have a recent statement by the defense minister saying that trying to look for justice amounted to revenge on the part of survivors. So there's some contradictory signs. In Uruguay, what we have here is a recent challenge by the Uruguayan Supreme Court of the amnesty law in that country, saying, ruling that was unconstitutional. You have also a sentence of the former or the last military ruler, and he was sentenced for 20 to 25 year prison for murder in October. But at the same time, again, in a little bit over a month ago, another referendum took place in Uruguay, and the proposal to overturn the amnesty law was defeated. Okay, so again, the Uruguayan population gave its support implicitly for the amnesty law, so on and so forth. Okay, again, the key bit here is to kind of take stock, if you will, not of transitional justice, but of some of the more recent trends regarding post-transitional justice here, to give you some of the context to the comments that I'd like to make. Okay, now, how can we explain these recent trends, okay, that have taken place over the course of a few decades? Now, as I said, there's certainly a range of key domestic factors to explain some of these common trends. First of all, of course, the very persistence of democratic rule in the region, despite itself, we could almost say, explain the fact that there is opening a political space to challenge the type of political bargains that were struck following immediately the transition to democracy. Of course, the improvement in civil and military relations as well plays a part, and particularly the role of victims' organizations that are important in a Latin American context that have challenged many of the negotiations that have taken place amongst political elites and with the military. So there's a range of domestic factors that also explain why there's some variability of outcomes. First, of course, the type of human rights abuses that I alluded to before during the dirty wars. The countries, it differs the time with regards to the time that has lapsed between the time of the abuse and the type of and the institutional efforts to provide remedies for these. Also, one has to understand that there's a significant difference in terms of the percentage of the population affected by the dirty war. Also, in terms of the identity of victims, okay, it does matter in human rights and politics of human rights whether the victims are middle class or they're indigenous, okay, population. Also, the type of the nature and the logic of repression is important to understand. In Argentina, the repression was decentralized, so the type of is problematic to investigate a decentralized system of repression. Whilst in Chile, for example, the repression was very much centralized, okay, so it's easier to find a figurehead for the repression of Pinochet. Yeah. So key differences. And there are also, of course, interested in thinking about the political context in which transitional justice take place. Of course, how important politically are human rights abuses? Very important in Argentina, not so important in Brazil. And also, we have to understand the ways in which judiciaries have emerged as political actors. Again, very broad type of claims here, but I'll get into details in a few moments. I know I'm keeping promising, but I will get there. Now, how does then the American human rights system fits into some of these processes that I tried to describe? Now, just to give you some background on the Inter-American system. Inter-American human rights system, I should say, is part of the Organization of American States that was set up in 1948. And through the adoption of a charter of the regional organization. At the same time, an American Declaration of Human Rights, or the Rights and Duties of Man, was adopted that, in fact, Latin American lawyers are happy to point this out, preceded the adoption of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. However, it took until 1959 to set up the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, that developed a practice of conducting detailed investigations regarding human rights violations in member states. The American Convention on Human Rights was adopted in 1969, but didn't enter into force until 1978. Okay, so by the end of the 70s, we had the system as we have it today, and it's a two-leg system, broadly understood. First, you have the mechanisms developed under the OAS Charter that puts the Inter-American Commission with a mandate to supervise human rights in member states. Secondly, you have the different mechanisms set up under the Inter-American Convention and the Inter-American Court. The Inter-American Court can receive individual complaints of human rights violations, and it issues advisory opinions. Okay, now, I think also it's important to understand the kind of political context in which the Inter-American system has developed. first, of course, the Inter-American system developed or was founded and had its initial institution development in the context of the Cold War and extensive period of authoritarian rule in the region. With the return of democracy, and this is really where we come in here, efforts to shape transitional justice became very important for the Inter-American system. And what in my research I'm predominantly paid attention or trying to pay attention to is the ways in which this has led to, how this has led to the Inter-American system trying to address the different human rights challenges that are taking place in the context of democratic rule. Okay. Now, thinking then through the various contributions that the American system has done to transitional justice particularly, I think it is important to point out, and people have done this, observers of the system point out, that the court or the American system has not developed jurisprudence specifically for transitional justice. It's a human rights regional human rights system. However, given the nature of the human rights challenges that the system faced, the transitional justice issues have played a very important part in its development. And broadly, you could say that over time, the American system has developed to become increasingly intrusive. And increasingly inquisitive, if you will, of the different political bargains that were struck in countries. Okay, so one of the key issues that I'm interested in is the ways in which the right to private petition, so the ways in which individual groups, or individuals and groups can petition the system, how that works and how that influences the ways in which the system inserts itself into transitional justice debates in various countries. Now, I'm going to skip a few things here, I guess. Now, the type of cases that the Inter-American system has dealt with has predominantly been concerned with, in the context of transitional justice, with issues surrounding forced disappearances, judicial guarantees in states of emergency, the admissibility of amnesty laws, the provision of domestic remedies for human rights victims, and broadly questions of accountability, okay, of past human rights abusers. Let me go through some of these things in detail. You notice that I'm speeding up now as I go along. I'm getting warm and into this. With regards to disappearances, the first three cases that were submitted to the court under its contentious jurisdiction involved the case of three cases of forced disappearances in Honduras. These are the famous Velasquez Rodriguez cases, or famous at least if you're nutty international human rights law, I should say, which I'm not, right? both nutty. Well, anyway, why am I? Okay. Now, in the case of the Velasquez Rodriguez cases, which were the first key cases through which the Inter-American system cut its teeth with regards to transitional justice, now the court affirmed quite strongly that states have a positive duty to conduct serious investigations, identify those who are responsible, and punish those who violate these rights, and also to provide compensation to victims. So, importantly here, in the case of disappearances, in effect, you don't know, it is not obviously known, the fate of these people. The court said that the state should be held liable for the whereabouts of these individuals, even if no direct link between the state and these individuals can be established. Okay, and that is important for reasons that we'll come to. So the Inter-American Court developed norms of jurisprudence related to impunity, okay, and it defined impunity as a systematic failure to investigate, prosecute, arrest, adjudicate, and convict those who are responsible for human rights violations. Okay, And the court has developed this idea to say that this is important. That is, impunity is detrimental because, on one level, it has societal consequences. Okay, impunity at a societal level fosters, in the words of the court, chronic repetition of human rights violations. And also, it is important because at the levels of victims and families, impunity fosters a defenselessness of victims, okay, who have the right to know the truth about the facts that wouldn't happen. Okay. So, strongly developing a duty to prosecute. Okay. And of course, that has implications for debates surrounding amnesty laws as they have developed in the Latin American context. Now, amnesty laws, as they were adopted in Latin America in various shapes and forms and at various points in time, basically relate to whether governments have the right to guarantee impunity to offenders, under argument that this is necessary for national reconciliation or to maintain democracy. And it goes against, of course, the idea that states have an international obligation to provide individual victims of systematic violations of human rights with an effective remedy. Okay, whether or not such a remedy jeopardizes the social good of reconciliation and political stability. Now, the Inter-American Commission has developed an important case law on these issues, and basically have come out to say that victims have the right to know the truth, okay, and amnesty laws should not prevent the establishment of the truth. And the Commission has even gone as far to say that victims have or society has a collective right to truth. Okay, I'm not quite sure exactly what that means, right? And the court has not gone as far down that line. But in this quasi-judicial universe in which the Commission finds itself, it also has a promotional aspect in its work, say that society has a collective right to truth, and this should not trump however the individual's victim's right to due process and humane treatment. Okay, so in the kind of tension that exists between truth and justice in the Latin American context, the Commission has come down squarely on the side of the victim to know the truth, but also to demand punishment and justice. Now, for the lawyers amongst you, Guy, I know you're you'll get to me on these issues, so I'll try to say something here. The Inter-American Court has developed a quite extensive jurisprudence on amnesty, at least the lawyers tell me. And it really, for the court, began with the Barrios Altos case in 2001. And the Barrios Altos case refers to a massacre that occurred by a special squadron of the Peruvian military under the democratically elected rule of Alberto Fujimori. And in this, following this, Fujimori adopted two self-amnesty laws, okay, that granted an immunity for prosecution to victims, to the military. Now, the court ruled that these amnesty laws, adopted under a democratically elected ruler, in fact violated victims' rights of access to justice in this particular case in Barrios Altos. Now, commentary, as I understand it, has centered on the fact whether this ruling has broad implications, whether it has general effects, whether it applies to this particular case or more broadly, and whether it applies to other countries in the region. Now, the court has said in case related to Chile that the self-amnesty laws have generic effects, that they are in violation of rights of victims to access justice, and that they should be repealed. Okay. Now, in the case of Chile, the Inter-American Courts in 2006 ruled that the amnesty law in Chile was incompatible with its international obligations. And interestingly, the Chilean representatives argued before the courts that this shouldn't matter, in fact, because we don't courts do not apply the law, the amnesty law. However, for the court, this was enough, not enough. The law needs to be repealed. This is not taken. This has not happened, of course, in Chile. But nevertheless, it's a very strong. Strong message with regards to amnesty laws that the Inter-American Court has developed. Okay. Now, why then? So that part, kind of what I'm trying to just highlight a few things, a few relevant bits with regards to jurisprudence and some of the norms that the Inter-American system has developed. In the kind of remaining time, I also now want to kind of spend a bit of time on why this matters, okay, what political effects these legal kind of reasonings or legal cases have. Now, in my own work, and what I'm looking at is trying to understand how domestic actors use the system. And one way of thinking about this is through the activism of civil society actors, of course. Now, in contrast to the European human rights system, in Latin America, NGOs play an important part in bringing cases before the Inter-American Commission. Now, the Inter-American system has, in many ways, become an important opportunity for victims and their legal representatives to bring claims outside the domestic jurisdictions to pressure the governments through international legal processes. Now, of course, we need to understand that the capacity of actors to mobilize law is unequal. Okay? So in some ways, to understand the impact of the system, its differential impact in various countries, this is a key factor to kind of look at the ways in which, for example, Argentine and Peruvian human rights activists have become very astute in using the system, whilst, for example, in Brazil, it's not so much the case, and even less for domestic actors in places such as El Salvador or Guatemala. So that's one issue, the role of civil society. Another important aspect of how the Inter-American system has inserted itself into domestic debates surrounding transitional justice, look at its impact on the judiciary. So here, what I'm interested in is to look at how judges can act as political actors. And in order to illustrate that, I know I'm heading a bit towards my time here, but I'd like to illustrate how domestic judiciary has become involved with the Inter-American system through a case illustration of the process that led up to the Supreme Court in Argentina overturning the amnesty provisions in that country. Okay. Now, very quickly, in 1987, following the adoption by Alfonsín of two laws, laws of punto final and due obedience laws, full stop and due obedience laws, that should be consistent. In 1987, the Supreme Court upheld the validity of these laws, arguing that it was not a role of the judiciary to sanction a democratically elected government and their political policy. In 2005, however, the very same court, Supreme Court, overturned this ruling by saying it assumed authority, it had authority to rule on these laws, and they declared that these laws were against the Constitution. Okay, so what has happened between 1987 and 2005? Now, in large part, what has happened is a shift in judicial thinking. And I argue it's partly a consequence of development of international human rights law and practice. So in this period between 1987 and 2005, we have the Velázquez-Rodríguez cases, for example, that shifted regional human rights jurisprudence with regards to amnesties and expanding the duty to prosecute on behalf of states. Also in 1992, the Inter-American Commission adopted a report on Argentina saying that these laws, full stop and due obedience laws, were incompatible with international human rights law. Following this, in a case submitted by a mother of a disappeared and who was also on the advice or on the executive board of a prominent Argentine human rights NGO, a process of friendly settlement between the Inter-American Commission, the petitioners, and the Argentine state led to the setting up of so-called truth trials in Argentine courts. Basically, these are trials through which criminal responsibility, or as you say, these are trials that try to provide effective enforcement of the right to truth, but cannot establish criminal liability for these cases. So they're focusing on establishing or to retrieve information from the military and police regarding the cases that they deal with. Okay. Also, throughout this period in mid 1990s, an increasing number of extradition requests were filed by Spanish judges asking for the extradition of military and police officers, Argentine military and police officers. And of course, there were some convictions in absentia of Argentine military officers in Paris and Rome. Now, this added to the pressure on judges in Argentina to do something about it. Either, as one of these judges told me, you know, either we do something or the French will do something. We have to do something, okay. Now, this led up to a 1998 derogation of these laws by the Argentine Congress. Okay, this was future-looking. Derogation of these laws were future-looking, didn't have retrospective effect. Nevertheless, it gave very much a kind of political signal to the judiciary that it's okay to go ahead with cases. Okay. Now, the way Argentine judges responded to these set of processes were that they tried not to challenge the full stop and due obedience laws full on, but tried to look at issues that did not fall within the scope of the amnesty laws, such as, for example, the illegal appropriation of children that would subsequently given away for adoption. And again, I could talk to any of these details, but I just want to get the broad development here. Now, in 2001, the laws of full stop and due obedience were directly challenged in a case before a federal judge. He said that these laws, in fact, contradicted the provisions included in the international treaties that Argentina was a party to. Okay, so in effect, these laws violated the human rights commitments by the Argentine state. Now, just a few days after his ruling, the Inter-American Court published his sentence in the Barrio Saltos case. Okay, and when this case was taken by the Chamber of Appeals, the judges in the Chamber of Appeals very extensively quoted verbatim the Barrios Altos case by justifying upholding the previous sentence declaring the full stop and due obedience laws to be null and void. Okay. Now, it took the Supreme Court until June 2005 to decide this case. and it upheld the unconstitutionality of these laws. Now, what has happened throughout this time? Partly, and you could see this in the reasoning of this of some of the Supreme Court judges who were still on the Supreme Court. For example, Justice Petracchi, he said that he altered his position. They kind of fully, took up the issue. So, what has changed? You know, you are the same person. What has changed? What makes you come up with a different verdict? And he said that in this time, in this period, international law has developed to such an extent that, in fact, amnesty laws are not allowed. And part of the story is, of course, that Argentina has incorporated many of the international human rights treaties into its constitution. Okay. Now, the point here that I'm trying to make is, of course, that throughout this process, the inter-American system has provided a set of norms and jurisprudence that has affected, to a certain degree, the thinking on behalf of the judiciary, or the higher echelons of judiciary in Argentina, of course. However, in Argentina, but across the region of Latin America, there's widespread variation in the willingness of judges to accept this type of reasoning and to engage with international human rights law, changed or not changed. And I think in my work, I'm trying to understand how some of the ways in which different factors that have to do with the judiciary affects its willingness or engagement with international law. And I there's a set of explanations for that has to do with factors relating to judicial independence, the type of national legal traditions that have developed, and also such things as legal education. Okay. It's perhaps you can expect a Supreme Court judge in Argentina to be fully versed in international human rights law. However, you cannot expect a lower level judge to be so. And perhaps in Argentina, yes, but in other countries, that expectation may not hold. Okay. So, does all this matter? Okay. Now, what I've been trying to argue throughout here, and perhaps in a very roundabout way, is that the transitional justice transitional justice policies as adopted in various Latin American countries have developed over time. Okay. And increasingly, many of the provisions or many of the policies, especially I realize this as I go through this, but specifically relating to prosecution, justice, and truth issues. I haven't touched upon reconciliation and all these other good things that perhaps partly belongs to transitional justice. However, what I'm saying here is that the inter-American system has inserted itself into these various debates surrounding what should be done and what can be done surrounding transitional justice. Now, whether this matters, I think, broadly depends on three, I guess, different things. One is that through the engagement of the American system with transitional justice issues, it has come out or has emerged as a strengthened system. It has developed a jurisprudence, a set of norms that relates to justice and rights, and it has had to confront government policies on a variety of these issues. However, I think one has to keep in mind that whilst doing that, the American system, of course, engages with states and confronts states with regards to events that took place in the 1970s and 1980s, broadly. Okay, and they had to deal with countries such as Chile, El Salvador, Honduras, Paraguay, and Peru. And they're not having to confront the human rights record of current governments. Okay, so that's one issue. However, despite this, the marker system, I have argued, has emerged more effective and has provided this kind of a political space for both debates and struggles between variety of actors that are involved in transitional justice. Okay. Now, the ways in which states have responded to these kind of pressures that are coming from the international and the inter-American human rights system varies, of course. In Argentina, the type of discussions and relationship is very dense. This is broadly sympathetic on behalf of the state at various levels. In Chile, it's more cautious. Whilst in Mexico, is in many ways is a rejection of state responsibility for the past. So state responses varies. Okay. Now, however, not just it matters on other levels as well. I would argue not just because of what it has done to the inter-American system itself. It matters, I think, at an individual level. And I think perhaps And I think we shouldn't forget that. Okay. And I just want to kind of. I realize I'm being taped, so I should choose my words more carefully here. But I just want to talk very briefly about some events that took place a few weeks ago in London. Okay, to kind of see that the inter-American system really matters. Okay, and this is the case of Tita Radilla. Whose father, Rosendo, disappeared in 1974 at the military checkpoint in Mexico. Okay. Now, Tita's father is one of approximately 1,000 cases of enforced disappearances during the Dirty War in Mexico. And most of these took place in the municipality, Otita's municipality. Now, the Mexican state throughout has rejected any state responsibility for these forced disappearances. Now, in July 2009, Tita's case, or the case of her father, became the first case of enforced disappearances against the Mexican state brought to the Inter-American Court, and the Inter-American Court's decision is due at some point in the next couple of weeks. Now, as with these type of cases, and Mexican government, as I said, has refused to clarify what happened to Tita's father and many of his contemporaries. However, it has in its wording accepted without reserve the disappearance and likely death, but it has rejected the fact that it is responsible for it, because this happened a long time ago. Okay, and it happened, of course, long before the Mexican state accepted the jurisdiction on the competence of the court. Now, in itself, this particular case, to my mind, when I'm speaking to Tita, I kind of asked her, so what do you expect and what do you hope to come out of this case? Okay, and now the Mexican state says it lacks jurisdiction. Then the Mexican state has refused responsibility throughout this whole process. Now, when she spoke about her experiences during these 35 years of trying to understand what happened to her father, okay, and she acknowledges the number of setbacks and so on and so forth. She said to me and to others that she hoped that these type of proceedings would put pressure on the Mexican state to shed light on what happened to her father. Now, to say that this process doesn't or matter or this is inconsequential, okay, would be clearly an affront to people like Tita. Okay, and hundreds of her that submit cases on a regular basis to the Inter-American Court. Now, it clearly matters for individual victims, and I think my point that I'm trying to make here, it matters not much for the judicial outcome of the specific case, but it matters because of the process that goes into engaging with the American state, faced with an unresponsive and state that rejects any responsibility. Okay, so it provides an important space to for victims and their organizations of relatives in particular to organize and to use the resources of the Inter-American system. Okay, now that is all fine, the litigating lawyer would say, okay, now I achieve my case, okay, I so on and so forth. But for the political scientist, does this all matter? Does it matter at a more general level? Now, I think what I'm trying to say here in conclusion is that, well, it matters depending on what your understanding of the objectives of transitional justice are. Now, if you adopt a very narrow conception, in my view, of what transitional justice is about, so it's related to past abuses, it seemed to matter because, in many ways, of the issues that I have been trying to describe here. In a broader sense, however, if you think about transitional justice as having something to do more broadly with the transition from dictatorships, authoritarian regimes, and civil wars, to the very real existing political systems that we have in place in Latin America today, does it actually matter? Okay, so this is related to trying to establish links between what happened to the past has and what's taking place in the present, to try to kind of understand how the system in this particular case can contribute through its institutional mechanisms and norms and jurisprudence regarding the past, how it could contribute to the ways we think about human rights and justice in the present. Okay. Now, there are a lot of different type of theoretical claims that are made on these issues, linking the past and the present. However, I think, of course, there's more kind of empirical work that needs to be done on this, and that's partly the broader objective of this project, trying to look at how post-transitional justice processes impact, if at all, on broader issues related to judicial behavior, rule of law, and democratic or the quality of democratic governance. Now, in conclusion, I'm leaving it a bit vague, but that's in my character, I guess. What I've been trying to say here is that through the ways in which the Inter-American system has developed through engaging with transitional justice issues, it has developed a very strong set of norms, jurisprudence, and institutional mechanisms. And I think from a political perspective, a set of relationships between domestic actors and the system. Okay. Now, that is all well, perhaps, with regards to these type of issues we're talking about, events that took place in the 1970s, 80s, perhaps in the 1990s, but does it actually matter now, okay, beyond the cases of these victims that we're talking about? Now, let me say two things in conclusion on that. I think it does matter, and it matters in part because of some of the very practices that the Inter-American system has condemned and pushed states on with regards to the past are very much taking place in the present. And this applies, of course, to torture, forced disappearances, and broader issues relating to impunity. Okay, and we could see these type of norms that the system has developed and the ways in which activities on behalf of civil society actors are being used in cases relating to present day, whether it has to do with police brutality, police violence in Buenos Aires, Argentina, or with massacres of peasant populations in Colombia. Okay, so that's one set of issues. But I also do think it matters for thinking about a broader set of issues. Okay, the way I've been thinking, of course, about transition justice as quite clearly a moving target. Okay, and I think the inter-American system has inserted itself through its engagement with transitional justice in these various countries as a key mechanism for dealing with human rights cases more broadly speaking. And there's huge differences from one country to another, of course. Let me kind of end on that inconclusive notes, as I'm running a bit short on time. But I think hopefully that's something to discuss on the basis of this.
Thanks very much, Mark.